לשידור ישיר ממחנה רמה בברקשיירס.
כל רמה 102.3 מגישים קיץ באוויר.
רדיו כל רמה 102.3 FM.
Shalom and welcome to another edition of Parsha Talk with Rabbi Elliot Malm in Highland Park, New Jersey, at the Highland Park Conservative Temple Congregation Anshe Emet. Joining me are my good friends, Rabbi Barry Chesler, Salman Sheikh of the Day School of Long Island, Rabbi Jeremy Kalmanowski Anshe Chesed, New York City. We are recording this. It's day 159 of the hostage saga, day 159 of the war. We are just filled with anguish for our families, for everyone who is going through this, and praying for their return. Jeremy, you had a rally. Your shul was present at a rally in New York City.
Go ahead. There's the Families Forum, which is here in New York, affiliated with the Mateh HaMishpachot in Kikar HaTufim's Hostage Square in Tel Aviv. Every Sunday they have a run around the reservoir at Central Park to keep everyone's mind on the hostages, bring them home. And because we weren't exactly at 150 days on Sunday, we were a little bit beyond it, but it was for 150 days. It was quite a large. It was about 3,500 people joined, and we had our bring them home now signs. We had the bring them home now chants. We had a lot of people. We had a bunch of people from Anshe Chesed who participate every Sunday, but especially this Sunday. There was Karen Mundar, who was one of the hostages who was released in the first unit. She was there and spoke. It was clear it was really tremendously difficult for her, and she wasn't super comfortable, I don't think, in English, but the folks helped her through that, and of course the crowd was extremely welcoming. And then the father, I didn't catch his first name, but the father of Tal Shoham, who is still imprisoned, still captive, he spoke incredibly powerfully at his anger to the government, who at least the reigning, I think, inclination is that prosecuting the war is a higher priority than bringing the hostages home. And he spoke about his anger at that. I certainly think that everybody in our group, who was there on Sunday, was like, as an Israeli friend of mine said, everyone wants to bring them home, and some people want to bring them home achshav, now, which means that there would have to be, a minimum, a pause or a ceasefire or some negotiation. And Israel has, as far as I understand, made ceasefire offers that Hamas has not accepted, but it's been so long. We are so worried, especially about the female captives, but everybody, it is a little weird when they all talk about women and children, and the father of Tal Shoham said, he said this explicitly. It's of course worried about the women and children, and I'm worried about my son too. The men as well. Elliot, I forgot to tell you this as we were preparing. Two kids that we know from camp, they're not kids anymore, they're grown-ups, they're college graduates. I saw and marched with them for a while. Maddie from your shul and Shelly. Remember them from...
Sure.
I marched with them on Sunday as well, which was nice.
Very nice. Wow, I read an article recently with Mati Friedman. Mati Friedman, a well-known journalist, has written very, very compelling pieces and books. And he talked about going to the border with an Israeli singer, Shlomi Shaban, I think it was. And they put speakers up and they blasted the music into Gaza. And as you were talking, I'm thinking, that we demonstrate and we pray and we do all sorts of things that evoke, what we want and what we're expressing. And where do the voices go? And you hope that they're going somewhere. You hope that they're moving something. They're moving public opinion, or they're moving, political forces, or they're moving each other, and we speak to that, you know, when we've been doing this, you know, from Shabbat to Shabbat, and of course during the daily prayers as well, praying for the Chatufim and praying for them, and you know, at a certain moment, 159 days, it's the anguish, but it's also the exasperation of it, and it's still, we're not going to lose hope. We're going to keep hope that that these prayers will be heard, and that they know somehow that we are hoping for them. And these days, of course, are changing. The season is changing. We feel that we're approaching the holiday of Purim, and that of course means that we're approaching Pesach. We're also approaching in our parsha here the end of the Sefer, the end of the book of Shemot. Can we just take a moment to pause and reflect on the arc of this book? And I know we have some thoughts about this, that the book starts out, you know, with the people becoming a people. Hine am b'nei Yisrael, Pharaoh says, because they have become so, prolific in Egypt. And we end this book, as we will describe shortly, having prepared this magnificent mobile sanctuary for God's presence. So that's an in between. Of course, we have plagues, miracles, the Exodus, the revelation of Sinai. But is there a broader theological arc to this book? And I'm going to flip the coin here and give Jeremy the toss.
Okay. Well, as you know, I'm a devotee of Rabbeinu Moshe ben Nachmanides, Spain to Eretz Yisrael, 1194, 1270. And he's tremendous, just the most amazing figure of the Jewish Middle Ages, you know, and among his gigantic halachic figure, gigantic Bible commentator, and important as a Kabbalistic thinker. And he has an introduction to the book of Shemot that I think is really interesting. You know, I think perhaps underlying your question, or the way many readers from among our communities read Shemot, the beginning is so thrilling. The narrative is so powerful. Mount Sinai is the most important theological moment in the Bible. And then the rest of it's the Mishkan. Like, what? You know, what got tacked on to this book? And it's, I think, to a contemporary, perhaps American reader, it seems a little, the stitching is a little strange. Ramban, however, says, no, this is exactly the point. The point is that in Genesis, our ancestors, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, he wouldn't have probably quoted the matriarchs, but we can quote Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, Bilea. They were so, at such a lofty religious level, God was present to them, accessible to them. They had revelations. They had personal messages. And then the people go into exile, and they are really crushed. And the point of this book is to redeem the people who have been alienated from that spiritual heritage. So Ramban says that the arc of the book is from the, you know, this is what we say about Passover, right? Mignut l'shevach, from degradation to exaltation. They've been sent into exile. They've been robbed of this religious heritage. And the point is to take them out of the physical suffering, to give them a tremendous religious experience, and then to create a venue, the Mishkan, the sacred space, in which they will once again have God in the midst of their community. And so for him, the building of the Mishkan, which we conclude this parasha, include this whole book, is the whole point of the book, is that once again, the Jews are in exile until such time as they have God in their midst, and that's exactly what happens. That's the climax of the book.
Are you saying then, to paraphrase the Ramban, is he saying that redemption is the presence of God in the midst of Israel, and wherever you go, right? Is that what he's saying?
He does not explicitly say, and the land doesn't matter.
No.
And I would note that in the end of his life, when he becomes driven away from Spain because of some political considerations, he does live in Eretz Yisrael. He spends the last 5 years of his life there. He's buried there. He cares a great deal about the actual place of Eretz Yisrael. However, what he says at his introduction to the book of Exodus is, redemption happens when they build the Mishkan. So I think that he imagines the people at the end of this book as fully redeemed. They may
Okay.
not have landed where they are going. They may still have a journey to make, but they are fully redeemed when they have a Mishkan in which the divine presence rests.
Barry, I want you to give your literary or
Well, far be it for me to disagree with Ramban,
yeah, but
but someone has to. So the phrase that came to mind when you were talking, Jeremy, was "Miyagon l'simcha," which is a variation of the phrase that you used. You know, again, from disgrace to joy. And I think the difficulty here is that very few of us associate the Mishkan with joy. I think the dominant emotion that the Mishkan conveys is yirah, fear or awe, and not joy. And I think that there's something unsettling in this book of Exodus, which begins with degradation, right? Israel comes into Egypt, a large, well, 70 people, 70 men at least, and soon becomes a nation. And then they enter slavery. And then slowly they will make their way with the great help of God's hand out of slavery. And then the book sort of veers off into building the Mishkan. And I think what we need to think about are a couple of things. First and foremost, that the Mishkan is both portable and I think intended to be temporary. And the Mishkan, I think, is going to morph into the temple, which is supposed to be permanent and stationary, which is a very different model of biblical religion. And the irony for me is that I think those of us living what we now like to call the diaspora, but traditionally we refer to as the exile, we are in the temporary world, not the permanent world, at least theologically speaking. And our symbol of the Mishkan doesn't resonate for many of us as much as the symbol of the temple does. And I think that requires some further discussion because we're left here at the end of Exodus with the overwhelming presence of God, so great that Moses himself cannot enter the Ohel Moed, the tent of meeting, but perhaps he can't enter because it's unnecessary. Because if God has completely filled it, what does Moshe need?
Interesting. So is both of you have you know, these lovely both mystical and kind of, you know, practical. And I am I'm thinking that the feeling I get at the end, and you know, again, with due respect to Ramban, nobody wants to disagree, and I'm not disagreeing, but the sense I get at the end of the book is we're ready. We're ready to go. Everything's packed.
Where are we going?
Well, we kind of know where we're going. We know that we're going from a place that's not here. We know that God has promised us a land, and that promise was already reiterated to Moses way back at the burning bush, and that's the program. The program is that you got out, and I'm your God. I made a covenant with you. We had a big moment. We had a big crisis and a catastrophe also, but now. Everybody, you know, we're thinking about having this space. We now have this space. The space is going to go with us as we make our way to this land. And that sense that we're, you know, I read the end of the book of Shemot, I feel exuberant about it. I feel like I feel sometimes when I take any kid of mine to the airport and everything is loaded on the in the luggage. We've checked in, and we're ready to go on the gate. You know, and I'm ready here for the next chapter. The next chapter is I'm ready to get into the land. But you know, in a way, I have this crescendo, and then we're going to get a whole book of this is what you do with the thing. This is what you do at the sacred spot. You make these sacrifices, you worship in this way, and you treat everybody in this way. You get a code that will teach you how to live with God in your community. which I think is essential to the whole story. So I'm not sure I see that there's redemption. I see readiness here. I see that we're just beginning.
One of the things that I like about, I mean, I like Nachmanides too, but one of the things I like about the approach that emphasizes readiness for what's next, as opposed to fully redeemed. At some level, it's appealing to say that redemption. I'm not speaking about the Bible. I'm just speaking about like being a religious human being. At some level, it's appealing to say that redemption is not like cosmic redemption in the infinitely distant future. It's a moment of real perfection. That itself is ge'ula, and you need no more. And as a religious person, it's appealing to say that the important religious moment is readiness for what comes next, because there's always going to be a what comes next.
Absolutely, absolutely. Okay, so with your permission, we have at the beginning of the parsha an accounting. It's quite elaborate in terms of the contents and all the materials, and it does give us a tally of everything, and then we get the accounting of the building. And stages of this, it's, you know, people reading it closely, Kasher Tziv Adonai et Moshe, that is a refrain seven times. There is certainly the parallel to the creation story here. I think that that's a deliberate parallel, obviously, and in the sense that we are creating a space for God opposite the world that God has created for us. I think that that's a point that of course many of the commentators make. And then we get to the end. Vayichal Moshe et Amlacha. It's over. It's completed. And Vayichal makes you think of Vayichal Elohim, Vayomash.
Vayichulu Hashamayim.
Everything is completed. And then Vayichas Anan et Oel Moed. So the cloud covers the tent. Uchvod Adonai Male et Amishkan, and God's glory, God's kavod fills it. I taught this week in my class, so this verse is very fresh with me. The there's a parallelism here that the cloud comes and God fills, and that parallelism is not found later on when Solomon dedicates the temple. It's very interesting, but that you'll have to see the companion piece to this in my class, which is on YouTube. But point is, and Barry, you touched on it, V'lo yachol Moshe lavo el ohel moed, he couldn't go in there. Ki shachan alav ha'anan, because the cloud dwelled on it, uchvod Adonai male et ha'mishkan. And I just want to, and the glory of God stayed in the Mishkan. So I want you to, let's take apart that and understand and try and figure that out. What you said before was, look, he can't get in there. There's too much God there, and you also said that there's a lot of year I want, so go there, and I want to counter that, you know, in a different way afterwards. Go, if you can. My question is, what did you mean before that the cloud when you interpreted this verse?
I think that, you know, we have the presence. Kavod can also mean presence, or the weightiness of God is completely filling the Mishkan. So there's no space. I'm reminded, I've been to be teaching a little bit about Lurianic Kabbalah to my 10th grade. So this is a kind of reverse of Tzimtzum. In the Tzimtzum, Luria imagines that God has to contract into himself in order to make room for the universe. Here, God expands, so there's no room for anyone. And, you know, I listening to you talk about Vayachal and Vayachulu, so there's a very nice assonance here with V'lo Yachol Moshe. We could read it that Moses could not stop either.
Well, I'm going to write that one down. I'm going to quote you.
Okay. It'll cost you, but so that Moses is prevented from coming to the Ohel Moed, And then we have this curious phrase, Kishachan alav ha'anan, because the cloud rests upon it. And then the Vav in Uchvod Adonai Malei Ad HaMishkan seems to need another interpretation. It can't be and, because that doesn't quite make sense. So maybe it's consequently or therefore. That meaning, once the cloud is there, God's presence fills up everywhere.
So the reason why I stopped on the addition, the idea of awe, fear, and reverence is because I'm trying to do the imaginative exercise of being in the audience, okay, and watching this happen, and the Torah pays absolutely no attention to the audience here. I don't know what the audience reaction is. I know later on in the book of Vayikra, you know, when stuff happens, when the flames come down and kindle the altar, Vayaronu, the people go crazy, okay? And I want them to go crazy here. I want the crowd to erupt in a big...
Well, they're dumbstruck because the image is that Moses has to go into the tent in order to commune with God, but he can't get into the tent because God is overly present.
So, but my point is, though, do you think that to Elliot Malamud watching this in the audience, to the average Israelite, they would have gotten it? They would have, when they see that the cloud comes over the sanctuary, that's pretty amazing, and it's pretty thick, you know. And
I think their jaws drop.
So they're stunned into silence, which may be, you know, the sanctuary of silence, you know, Yisrael Noel here. I mean, that it may be that we're in a priestly world where the silence of these experiences is what is being reflected, and the people are just in too much awe.
So I just want to add something here. So what makes silence so curious here is that our association with creation is speech.
Yes. Right?
God brings the world into being by speaking. And if there is silence, one can ask, where is God? But the answer here is that God is not in the word. He's in the presence. That there's something physical here that I think the people respond to.
So what does it mean that he can't get in? And it's too thick. This is what
I think it means that he's with the people.
That he's with the people. Nice.
He's not separated. Right when he goes into the Ohol Moed, he's one of a kind.
Okay.
No one else goes in there.
But he can't.
If he can't come in, then Moses is actually part of the people. He's no longer Isha Elohim, the man of God. He's Isha Am. He's the man. He's Achad Ha'am, I guess we would say.
He's Achad Ha'am. Yeah, though that's important. Yeah,
he's one of the guys.
So maybe I'm going to take this into the sermon, which is there's only this. This is a singular moment, a unique moment. And at this unique moment, he's part of them. He's like he'll have his opportunity to go.
Right. It's only a unique moment in this passage because the passage ends by saying this is going to come happen again and again and again.
And he's going to be able to go there. He's going to be well. You're identifying the pillar of cloud with the cloud that's here. That may be the case. But the singularity of this moment is that there's so much cloud he can't get in. And that's where it's going to have to be left, right? Until, of course, the time that they have to move forward. I don't know. Jeremy, have a...
I'm thinking about the... just Googling over to... chapter 39, verse 43. The end of chapter 39. I first of all, I love the thought. Just like at Sinai, Moses is up, he's down, he's up, he's down, he's up, he's down. It's not exactly clear where he is. It's possible to read that passage back there on Exodus 19 as when the revelation finally happens, Moshe is down with the people. And so similarly here, I like that a lot. At the end of 39, just before they actually kind of set it up,
Right.
Moses saw everything they had done. And they had done it exactly as God had commanded. So they indeed they did. And Moses blesses them. And there's the great line, familiar to appropriated in Fiddler on the Roof. What's the Midrash says? What's the blessing that he offers them? I'll read it from Rashi here. Yehi ratzon shetashresh shechina b'maaseh yedeichem. May it be God's will that the divine presence will rest on the work of your hands. And it's just, this is just such a great expression of the covenantal quality of this religion. There's some stuff that people do that makes the divine manifest. I mean, okay. That's Judaism in a nutshell. There is things that you can do in this world, which can be hard, which can be difficult, which can be unfair, which can be suffering, but there are things that you can do, and the divine presence will rest on your achievements.
So what I'm smiling is because you're giving voice to the exuberance of this moment and a joy, that there's a joy. And Barry, you know, this conflicts with what you said, that there's awe here. Vayevarech otam Moshe, to me, you know, sound, and you know, you hear what Jeremy said was, that's a joyous moment. It's a moment of culmination, a moment where everything is coming together. You know, it's like we're ready. We're all together. There's a unity here. There's a perfect moment here, and it's joyful. And yet, what we're describing in the very next chapter possibly could have this exuberance. I want the exuberance there, but I hear silence and I do hear awe. And maybe, you know, the homily is that there's both here in this moment, that there's tremendous joy, but there's also tremendous yirah.
I mean, an opposition that if there's joy, there's no awe. It's gilu berada.
Gilu berada. Ivdu et Adonai b'simcha v'gilu berada. This is serve the Lord with joy and rejoice with trembling.
Right, yeah. But I want to offer a slightly different take, that the joy, at least for the Hasidim, it comes with mitzvah, right? We talk about simcha shel mitzvah, not simcha im hashchina, not joy in God's presence. I still want to emphasize the awe part, although you make very clear your position. But I want to draw your attention to the end of chapter 7 in the book of Numbers, because here we get a different account of what happens when the Mishkan is established. And here it's set up and God and Moses can go into the Ohel Moed. And, you know, the rabbis have a problem with this, which they will resolve next week with the opening verse of Vayikra, which we'll talk about, I guess, next week. But, you know, what suggests that this is unique, Elliot, is that in the other places where we have a sense of the Mishkan coming into presence, into being, Moses is not prevented from entering the Ohel Moed. So it could be that this is the moment when he cannot, and it quickly passes.
Yeah.
And then that would lead to the joy. That I would go so far as to agree with you there.
Right. In that passage there, there's a sense that God can really speak to Moses. And that, so, you know, there is at the core of this, you know, the reconstitution of this relationship, that Moses and God had a relationship on Sinai where, as you described, there was going up, going down, going up, and he finally goes up again, and God is unmediated at Sinai. But here, this is not Sinai. This is going to be the replica of Sinai that they're going to portage with them. It's a portable Sinai. And it's mediated. It's Kvod Adonai. It's Anan Adonai. It's God, you know, that direct one-to-one unmediated communication between God and Moses only happened at Sinai. It's not going to happen anywhere else. And in a way, that the book has to work that way. There has to be only one moment. There's no other founding moment. There's no, you know, you don't get a repeat, basically. Everything is a replica. And that's okay. We can live in the replica. We can live, you know, with the idea that we're carrying it around with us. And maybe that's also part of it. And the silence, I think, is also that. We're taking this moment of holiness with us. It's very hard, I think, for contemporary audience to enter into this world. Because we have such an alienation from things that are holy altogether. I struggle with this every year when trying to convey this. And, you know, we try to make sense of it by talking about our synagogues. We try to make sense of it by talking about our homes. We try to make sense of this by talking about making, you know, the sanctity of a certain mitzvah, or choosing a mitzvah, or having, you know, one special zone of holiness in your own life. Very, very difficult. People don't ordinarily think about that. And it's, you know, in terms of, you know, the world right now, it's very hard to you know, imagine these things. I was thinking about Psalm 27, which is, you know, in the heart of that Psalm is, Achat she'alti me'et Adonai, one thing I ask of you, God, Otavakesh, this I request, Shifti b'veit Adonai kol yemei chaye, that I dwell now, so Lord, all the days of my life.
Right, but how is he going to dwell? He's going to dwell in silence, because the response to the divine word here is silence. It's not speech.
So he's going to dwell in silence, which is, so he's yearning for the relationship, he's learning for connection, and he's learning for peace.
There's a great story in one of Buber's writings, which I don't remember completely well, but basically two men come to a park bench, sit down, don't say a word for half an hour, each gets up and leave and feels complete.
Yeah.
And that sense of silence, I think, is something that is conveyed here at the end of Sefer Shmot.
So this calls to mind, so to speak, Buber's Chavruta, Franz Rosenzweig, who this the richness of this conversation about, this is a highly cognitive religion, right? And what's going to come next in Sefer Vayikra is it's blood and guts there too, but got a lot of things to say about how you worship, and there's lots of precise rules, and there's, you know, a very, very full set of rules, expectations, and you got to know them, and you got to study them, and you write commentaries about them. You know, but Rosenzweig, in his, you know, writing with Buber about law, Rosenzweig is in favor of law, Buber's against law. Rosenzweig says, you know, really, revelation is just Vayered Adonai. God shows up. And that's the whole revelation. Yeah. And as soon as we get to, and they're speaking, that is, for him, commentary on just the revelation of just presence. Okay? Now, whatever, there's some shortcomings to this too. It gives you a Judaism that is just like entirely experiential and diminishes the cognitive perhaps too much. But it really does accord nicely with this passage, that it's showing up, in which the human encounters the divine. That is like totally sufficient. And then you're going to start telling me about meat and milk. Okay. And then you're going to tell me about don't eat chametz on Pesach. So the religion of presence and encounter, you know, we saw a little bit also, we talked to, you know, 2 weeks ago about the post golden calf, you know, just the God says, I'm going to bring all my goodness past you. And Moses is going to say, oh my, wow. You know, and that's like the high religious moment.
Yeah. We go to so many places, and we've come to the conclusion. We've come to the end of the book, end of the Parsha talk, there's a lot of comfort in that. There's a lot of comfort in knowing all of these things, on all the different strategies of reading this chapter, this Parsha, and of course this book, redemption, and also getting ready, and also joy, also a little bit of awe. Put it all together. At the end, we say Chazak, Chazak, Venit Chazek, wishing everyone who has joined us, first of all, thank you so much. We're honored by that. Thank you for making us a part of your week, and we know you do, because we get the responses and the reports that people are actually reading and viewing this, listening to this, and sometimes other rabbis and other people using our Divrei Torah in their speech, which is the ultimate honor, So thank
you. We give them to you. We don't ask anyone back.
No, it's amazing. It's just amazing. And we thank you. And wishing everybody Chazak Chazak Benit Chazek to the entire, to our community and communities and the Klal Yisrael. We should all have the strength to manage through these difficult and challenging times. We'll see you next week on the next edition.
Bye.
FM.